right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, February 2nd, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. Happy Groundhog Day. Punxsutawney Phil actually saw a shadow. So that means we have another 6 weeks of winter and cold here in upstate New York. The current temperature is 13 degrees with a real feel of minus 11 with snow fog right now. So I'm about ready for spring. So where did we leave off yesterday? We titled the show, The Robots Are Coming to Take All the Jobs. We had played, maybe this was 2 days ago. It was 2 days ago. We had played three different excerpts from a mini documentary put out by AJ Plus, which is Al Jazeera's media arm. Say what you will about Al Jazeera, but I still have to say I thought they did a pretty excellent job just kind of illustrating what is coming and most people do not realize. Automation and this whole rollout of the Internet of Everything is coming faster than we can even imagine. There are global timelines across all of these different disruptive technologies, and there is a big chess play being made right now. And we can all be addicted to our dopamine carrot of devices and convenience, but the joke is going to be on us. Once that gets to the point where everything we do, think, see, say, which already kind of is, but even worse than it is now, is logged, bagged, tagged, and put on a blockchain somewhere forever to be then collated by some sort of artificial intelligence, to have a profile of some kind drawn upon you, and eventually have some sort of digital twin. That's kind of a new buzz phrase I've been seeing quite a bit in regards to AI and doing a lot of things in virtual reality as opposed to actual reality. But these digital twins, we saw that with the baby X from the guy who had worked on the movie Avatar. He had created this baby X that was this artificially intelligent, synthetically, biologically programmed baby, like all the way down to the smallest detail. You could zoom in on this baby's eye and bzz, 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 all the way down to the neurons in the brain and see what is happening when the baby is interacting with you through the camera, and it can see you and hear you. And he would leave toys out and stuff, or the baby would work on puzzles. It was very bizarre. I'll leave a link to that in the notes. But Baby X was probably a very good example of a digital twin. But someday, with this uploading to the cloud, we, some of you maybe, watched the carboncopies.org presentation on Sunday, January 28th, back last week, in regards to mind uploading. And there were some neuroscientists and smarty pants from the labs that had talked at that very long conference that mysteriously isn't completely up on the web, so I don't know what happened to that. But it is the plan. It is what they are looking at. This whole rollout, global rollout of 5G that is coming is for ubiquitous connectivity. We have talked about that before. That is the control grid that's going to be able to pull data 24/7. And this whole blockchain underlaying all of these technologies is going to be the quote-unquote immutable database that logs all of this information in a fashion that isn't easily deleted, number one. Number two, is distributed, so they don't need to have these massive data centers that are targets for attack, let's say. Also gives them encryption as part of this base way that the technology works, so they'll have some sort of security because everything is insecure in the Internet of Things. And then they have this basis of cryptocurrency. It doesn't matter whose bit shit it is. You make it whatever. We could have the jewel coin. I joked about that before. But if people believe in it enough and they start buying them and you have a good message or story behind it for some project that you're funding, you know, it could become a viable way for crowdsourcing, and a lot of people could have ownership in a project that then pays them micropayments for whatever they're doing, exchanging information or biometrics or whatever. You could sell, like, all your daily tasks back to the machine for a payment back to your digital your digital bank account, let's say. So there's I can actually see how all of these pieces can work together. And because the robots are going to be taking all the jobs, we're going to have to find a way to fund that universal basic income. One of those ways, not only are we going to be selling our data to the machine, but I'm going to predict that we are also going to become, you know, they're talking about equality, and we're going to talk a lot about some of this today. It's longevity medicine, mad science gone mad, living forever in immortality, and this quest by the rich billionaires to find this fountain of youth. This has been a historic search back from the days, I believe, of Ponce de Leon and the Spanish conquerors looking for that real fountain of youth that would allow them to live forever. And this has kind of been a lot of science over the last 50, 60 plus years or so. They have been doing things that are ethically questionable, at least by some of the people that might listen to this show, in the laboratories that are down long, dark hallways, behind locked doors with no windows, where you hear muffled screams and squeals, because we don't know what they're really doing. I was a fan of the X-Files back in the 90s, and a lot of the things that stuck with me about that series, say what you will, I wasn't really a conspiracy theorist, though I did at that point want to believe in aliens, though I think it's all bullshit now with all that I've learned. I think a lot of that was ours, and a lot of these mad science gene-crossing experiments that we found out that they were working on even back in the 70s at Fort Detrick, Maryland, part of the Biowarfare Project. It was in some documentation from an interview that we read with one of the generals that had run that back at that time in the New York Times. And now, because I mentioned I'm going to have to find a link to that, it was quite a gem to find, but it was a pretty telling interview. So anyway, I think this is where we're going to start today. I found an article out of BBC. This was from a few weeks back. Actually, it was from a year and a few weeks back. January 5th, 2017, titled The Birth of Half-Human, Half-Animal Chimeras. The quest to create animals with human organs has had a long history. And remember, Georgie Porgy Church is involved in a lot of this xenophobic transplantation stuff that they are working on with pigs, where they are putting human genes into pig embryos and trying to grow human organs. Or maybe they're doing it with stem cells. I don't know. We'll get there. And now it is becoming a reality. Has science taken a step too far? Well, I'm going to say yes. I don't know. You can argue with me on that, but I think I have a pretty good argument. We have stepped into places that, out of our wildest nightmares, and I know I've had quite a few over my 50-plus years, I never imagined that we would literally be facing real crap like this in the news. All right, so let's start the story. In H.G. Wells's Isle of Dr. Moreau, the shipwrecked hero, Edward Petternick, is walking through a forest glade when he chances upon a group of two men and a woman squatting around a fallen tree. My sister actually worked on the movie Isle of Dr. Moreau. I'm going to tell you one little secret I know. The cheetah ate the monkey. And that was for real. That actually happened when they were making that movie. All right, so they are naked apart from a few rags tied around their waist with fat, heavy, chinless faces, retreating foreheads, and scantily bristly hair upon their foreheads. Petternick notes that I never saw such bestial-looking creatures. And as Petternick approaches them, they attempt to talk to him. But their speech is thick and slopping as their heads sway as they speak, reciting some complicated gibberish. I think he took a bunch of quotes from the book. Despite their clothes and their appearance, he perceives the irresistible suggestion of a hog, a swish taint in their manner, and they are, he concludes, grotesque transvestites of men. Wandering into Dr. Moreau's operating room one night, Petternick eventually uncovers the truth. His host has been transforming beasts into humans, sculpting their bodies and their brains with his own image. Now, isn't this the type of stuff that they are really potentially doing? You don't think that they're messing around in some of those clone factories in China with trying to create some sort of animal-human hybrid with war-fighting traits that they might be able to put in a battlefield and make cannon fodder? Because I would say probably super soldier projects from the U.S. military. I mean, that's been talked about for a very long time in some of the DARPA literature. Just don't think that that stuff isn't really going on. But despite his best efforts, he can never eliminate their most basic instincts, and the fragile society soon regresses to dangerous anarchy, leading to Moreau's death. Yes, because his creation rebelled against him. Wasn't that the lesson in Frankenstein? It is 120 years since Wells first published his novel, and to read some recent headlines, you would think that we are veering dangerously close to his dystopic vision. Frankenstein scientists developed part human, part animal chimeras, claims the UK Daily Mirror in May 2016. Scientists want to break down the fence between man and beast, the Washington Times declares 2 months later, fearing the sentient animals would soon be unleashed upon the world. And remember, we read maybe a month or so ago about those little mousies that they had spliced human brain stem cells, little mini brain balls, into their heads. So they made these mouse-human-brained mice, which, you know, then begs to question, will these mice be able to talk? Well, who knows? This is all uncharted territory. The hope is to implant human stem cells into an animal embryo so it will grow specific organs. The approach could, in theory, provide a ready-made replacement for a diseased heart or liver, eliminating the wait for the human donor and reducing the risk of organ rejection. These bold and controversial plans are the culmination of more than 3 decades of research. And these experiments have helped us understand the biggest mysteries of life, delineating the boundaries between species and exploring how a rag bunch of cells in the womb coalesce and grow into a living, breathing human being. With the new plans to fund projects, we are now reaching a critical point in this research. And remember, part of Obama's Precision Medicine Initiative and the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act in December of 2016 is fueling a lot of what is happening now in these mad science laboratories, where they aren't looking at the ethics. They are just going exponential. Remember the story I read the other day? Without looking back, and the money is raining from the sky. It's all in the name of being a happier, healthier species, all created in someone else's image. And to keep you safe, of course, and to keep costs down, to do more with less, and to fix everything that's broken, like our healthcare system. Things are moving very fast in this field today, says Janet Russett at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, one of the early pioneers of chimera research. It is going to open up a new understanding of biology. That is, provided we can resolve some knotty ethical issues. Oh, yes, those pesky ethical issues. And questions that may permanently change our understanding of what it means to be human. For millennia, chimeras were literally the stuff of legend. The term comes from Greek mythology, with Homer describing a strange hybrid of immortal make, not human, lion-fronted and snake-behind, with a goat in the middle. It was said to breathe fire as it roamed in Asia Minor. In reality, chimeras in science are less impressive. The words describe any creatures containing a fusion of genetically distinct tissues, and it can occur naturally if twin embryos fuse soon after conception, with striking results. Consider the bilateral, and I don't know if we're going to get this much into detail, gametomorphs, which sounds like it came out of a Harry Potter book, in one side the body is male, the other side is female, and these animals are essentially two non-identical twins joined down the center. Wow, I've never heard of that one. And if the two sexes have wildly different markings, as in the case of many birds and insects, this can lead to a bizarre appearance, such as the northern cardinal, It has grown bright red plumage on half of its body while the rest of it was gray. Most often, however, the cells mix to form a subtler mosaic across the whole body, and chimeras look and act like the other individuals within the species. There's even a chance that you are one yourself. Studies suggest that at least 8% of non-identical twins have absorbed cells from their brother or their sister. And the mixed bag of animals from Greek legends certainly cannot be found in nature, but this has not stopped scientists from trying to create their own hybrid chimeras in the lab. We're not going to get any more detail. I mean, we've talked about all kinds of crazy stuff, and chimeras is just one of many. All right, so then I ran across a couple stories over the weekend that caught my attention, and these are very questionable. But I'm going to say, just because of some of the things that we've already read about, I'm not questioning these too much. Renowned scientist claims a humanzee was born in an American lab before it was killed by panicked doctors in the 1920s. Now remember, we found out when we looked back at Bell Labs and some of the technology that Bell Laboratories had and their innovation timeline, and when they started messing around with certain technologies, it was quite shocking that it was probably 20 or 30 years before I ever imagined, and that was even coming from a technology background, that this technology had existed. And we're not talking about chimeras. We're talking about some of this radio technology, microwave, and being able to bend wavelengths and do all kinds of directed energy things that were pretty surprising to me. So I would not doubt that in the 1920s, they may have had some other advanced technologies that we didn't know that they were messing around with. So a scientist has claimed, and this was January 30th, 2018, that a humanzee was born in an American lab nearly 100 years ago before being killed by panicked doctors. Renowned evolutionary psychologist Gordon Gallup told The Sun that the human-chimpanzee hybrid was born in a lab in Orange Park, Florida. Gallup, who developed the famous mirror self-recognition test, which proved that primates could acknowledge their own reflection, coined the term humanzee to refer to a chimp-human crossbreed. Hold on, I gotta scroll past the big pictures. He told the newspaper that his former university professor claimed that the humanzee baby was born at the research facility where he used to work. Gallup, who is currently a University of Albany professor, told The Sun that the professor worked at Yerkes before the research center moved to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia in the 1930s. One of the most interesting cases involved an attempt in which was made back in the 1920s, in which the first primate research center established in the U.S. was in Orange County Park, Florida. They inseminated a female chimpanzee with human sperm from an undisclosed donor and claimed not only that the pregnancy occurred, but the pregnancy went full term and resulted in a live birth. We found out that a lot of this undocumented research that the researchers themselves typically use themselves as the pot of genetic material to put into their experiments. But who knows? But in the matter of days or weeks, they began to consider the moral and ethical considerations, and the infant was euthanized, Gallup told The Sun. Gallup's term humanzee became well known in the 70s after the emergence of a chimp known as Oliver, a bald chimp who walked on his hind legs. Despite claims that Oliver was a human-chimp hybrid, tests later proved that the animal was not a humanzee. Russian biologist Ilya Ivanov in the 1920s tried and failed to create a Soviet super soldier, ding ding, using human sperm and female chimps. And another reported case happened in China in 1967 where a female primate became pregnant with a human hybrid but died from neglect after the lab scientists were forced to abandon the project. Gallup claims that humans can be crossbred with other apes and not just chimpanzees. All the available evidence, both fossil, paleontological and biochemical, including the DNA itself, suggest that humans can also breed with gorillas and orangutans, he added. The spokeswoman for the Yerkes National Primate Research Center said, quote, we have not been involved in any human-zee experiments, but rather conduct and enable peer-reviewed research studies to help fight disease and improve human health. Ding, ding, ding. Key phrase there. That's how they justify all this mad science. It's all about protecting you and making you better or live forever or healthier or to keep you safe. So now, here's a brand new story. February 1st, yesterday, 2018. Is your immortality waiting in a petri dish? Well, I don't know. Let's find out. All right. News that Chinese scientists have successfully cloned two mock monkeys has tongues wagging about the possibility and the ethics of cloning another primate and Homo sapien. Somehow, I feel that I have seen this movie before, says the author of this story, and I don't know if I have a name, Tom Keenan. Years ago, I interviewed an author named David M. Rorkvick, and aside from being an alumnus of Columbia University School of Journalism, his main accomplishment was a book called In His Image, The Cloning of a Man. It claimed that in 1973, a wealthy American identified only as Max had recruited a team of scientists to clone a son of his from DNA and that the baby was alive and kicking. The book made sensational reading, and in a 1970s version of Going Viral, it hit the front page of the New York Post. Scientists were uniformly skeptical, but Rorkvick maintained his story was true. And after a four-year legal battle, Rorkvick's publisher issued a statement saying that it believed that the book was a hoax. J.P. Lippincott also paid $100,000 to a British researcher who claimed that Rorkvick had plagiarized his PhD thesis. That was then, this is now. We have had Dolly the cloned sheep since 1996, and now these adorable monkeys named Zong Zong and Hua Hua. Putting them together gives you the word Zhuanghua, which is the Mandarin name for the Chinese people or nation. There is a patriotic research fervor afoot in that country as they strive for world leadership. And yes, China is coming. And they also have fewer legal and ethical hurdles to jump than Western researchers. Unlike Dolly, monkeys were cloned with a process called somatic cell nuclear transfer. And this involves removing the nucleus from a healthy, unfertilized egg and inserting the nucleus from the donor cell. In Dolly's case, that cell was taken from a mammary gland, and her name was a cute homage to Dolly Parton's cleavage. I didn't know that. There is also a Frankensteinish step in the process that involves zapping the egg with an electric current, which is interesting. One of the key enhancements that made the monkey experiment work was taking the donor cells from an embryo, not an adult monkey. Still, success rates were very low. The Chinese researchers reported that they used 127 eggs and implanted 79 embryos to wind up with just two monkeys. However, scientists do see great value in having genetically identical animals for research into disease, like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Of course, it's all about brain research, right? What about our own possibilities for achieving immortality in the spirit that possibly mythical clone buyer, Max? Well, we've learned never to say never when it comes to scientific process, because ethics go right out a window when it comes to money, right? And the odds are that you'll be able to order up a genetic mini-me anytime soon is probably slim. And if you ever did, other factors from environmental to epigenetics would mean that your offspring would be substantially different from you anyway, even though your clone would be a terrific organ or tissue donor for you. That grisly possibility forms the plot of a Jodie Picoult novel called My Sister's Keeper. It's worth noting that scientists who did the monkey business clearly state they are not working on cloning humans, wink, but they do have a cloning factory in China, and that can do humans, according to the owner. However, I have little doubt that someday, somewhere, someone is trying to do just that, and it might even be an amateur in a clandestine rogue lab, right, like Mammy's back bedroom, or in a garage somewhere in the city, since cloning methodologies are openly published. And as for the equipment, it's amazing how much used lab experiment equipment is sold cheaply on eBay, and we've read about that before. Another more conventional route to form a male immortality would have... Hold on 1 second. I can't scroll here. Would be probably to extend your own lifespan. Most experts are talking about humans routinely living into their 11th, 12th, and 13th decades. More conventional route to have a form of male immortality would be to have some of your sperm frozen with orders that it be thawed and used somehow in, say, 100 years. The thriving sperm bank industry shows that this technology is pretty reliable. And there are reports of healthy babies being born from sperm that were frozen almost 30 years. So 100 years is not a stretch. Yes, our body moving parts are about to wear out, but cloning technology may be a help there too by providing a good and non-controversial source of pluripotent stem cells. These can grow into almost any kind of body cell and are genetically identical to the donor, so there is little chance of rejection. We have talked about those pluripotent iPS stem cells before. They can create them from just scraping a little bit of your skin. And I'm going to take this opportunity to mention the fact that Clint Richardson invited me to be on this Sunday with him and Patrick Jordan. And he told me that they were going to talk about stem cells and stuff. So hopefully if things go well for me here on Sunday, I will be a part of that conversation. I haven't yet spoken to Patrick, so this will be kind of fun. Anyway, so to get back, so that'll be Sunday night at 5 p.m. Eastern, this coming Sunday. The Bio Innovation Organization gives a near future scenario where, quote, a middle-aged man suffers a serious heart attack while hiking in a remote part of a national park. By the time he reaches a hospital, only a third of his heart is still working, and it is unlikely he will be able to return to his former active life. He provides scientists a small sample of skin cells, ding ding, and technicians remove the genetic material from his skin cells and inject it into donated human eggs from which the chromosomes have been removed. So they suck out the nucleus. I'm trying to remember what that was called, some sort of transmutagenic something. And those altered eggs will yield stem cells that are able to form heart muscle cells. And to make it into the centurion or super centurion, which is the over 110 club, you will also need to do your part in terms of healthy living. That's why everybody's going to wear Fitbit someday. But the rewards of seeing some amazing and possibly terrifying biomedical developments will mean it will be fun to stick around or not, I would say. So where do we go from here? Well, hopefully if this tab stops spinning, the one that I was just on, hold on, we can get to the next one. Or we might have to sing the elephant song. Oh, no. Don't do this to me. It's because it's cold. All right. Well, I see what the tab is supposed to be. So maybe... Oh, here it is. All right. So then there was a story that came out. I think it was this morning. Titled, this is in a Google alert that I set up a couple months ago about immortality. So there's a whole bunch of immortality stories. Bottled water advertising, tap into the human desire for immortality. And that is according to a study from the University of Waterloo in Canada. I believe they're in Canada. Bottled water advertisements play on our innate fear of dying. This might be a lot of psycho-techno babble. Boosting sales, even though people may not know it may be the best choice for them or the environment, says a University of Waterloo study. While sometimes we think that we are rational beings, there are unconscious things that motivate us, says Stephanie Cote, who conducted the research while a Waterloo graduate student. bottled water advertisements target our deep-seated fears about immortality and, I mean, about mortality, which pushes people to avoid risks, especially in the face of daily reminders when they pass a funeral home or tragic stories like the ones in the news. We try to distract ourselves or push death into an undefined future time, so drinking bottled water can be among those decisions to keep it at bay because it seems more untouched, pure, and neatly packaged compared to tap water. They market it as coming from pristine natural environments, and the advertising apparently is working. Canadians bought up to 2.4 billion liters of bottled water in 2013, and this year that amount is expected to rise to 3 billion liters, despite ongoing campaigns urging people to avoid bottled water. Why do they do that when they have this cheap, great, highly regulated supply of tap water, asked Cote. It is because they want to. It is not because they need to. And to get a better understanding of what is motivating people, the research team analyzed bottled water campaigns, advertisements, websites, photographs, and videos. And the study was based on social psychology's terror management theory, which I thought was quite interesting, which argues that efforts to repress a conscious and an unconscious fear of death influences behavior such as those related to consumption, wealth, and status. Bottled water advertisers have done a good job reaching out to a broad range of people, including those who value appearance, fitness, wealth, class and status, and even environmentally minded consumers through the promotion of thinner recyclable bottles. They appear to a greater diversity of people, where tap water promotion, on the other hand, focuses primarily on financial, ethical, and environmental benefits. But to get more people on board with drinking municipal water, new tactics are needed to tap into those feel-good emotions that drive people's decisions. Tap water campaigns are narrow and have trouble competing with the broadly effective bottled water promotions. Yeah, especially when you see communities going to, all to be green in the name of conservation, going from toilet to tap water. And I saw that there were some places in Texas back when they were talking about severe drought that were talking about that. And, of course, that is kind of horrifying to me, toilet to tap water. So, all right. So where do we go from here? So tap water campaigns, apparently, according to the smarty pants at the universities, are tapping into that innate desire to live a long and healthy life and potentially for immortality and for defying death. We read a story back a few days ago from Nikolov, and I don't remember his last name, Nikolov Danilov was his name, about the dangers of going exponential. And he had called out Singularity University and some of its founders, not by name, Kurzweil and Desmandias, about selling exponential, selling immortality, selling the promise of all of these things that potentially, if not carefully executed, could potentially lead to our destruction, not only as a species, but as a planet, as a diversity that gets mixed up. It gets in a lot of trouble. Uh-oh, I'm really having problems here. Well, we might have to really sing. All right, hold on. We'll have to get back to my page on this other computer, so if I have to maybe try to salvage things. All right, what do we have? All right, I have a New York Post article, if I can scroll down and find it. Here it is. So, about the dangers of going exponential, and one of the things we had talked about the other day that we had ended the show on was an MIT Media Lab director that had gone to Davos. Remember at Davos, they've been talking about a lot of these technologies over the last few weeks. And he had said, think twice about immortality and the singularity. And even somebody who is in the field of these disruptive technologies is questioning the lack of ethics and this push forward just to go forward, not looking at the potential consequences. Well, a story out of the New York Post today, actually this was January 6, 2018, but over the last month, scientists could one day make humans immortal. On January 12, 1967, James Bedford, a psychology professor at Glendale College in California who had just died of cancer, took his first step at coming back to life. On that day, the professor became the first ever frozen in cryonic suspension, embedded in liquid nitrogen at minus 321 degrees Fahrenheit. Remember, we found that cryogenics is a big thing that they are talking about now for immortality and being able to even upload yourself to cryogenically freeze yourself and then get little splices and dices at very precise measurements and high definition scans of brain slices to try to recreate you in the machine. Bedford was neither the first nor the last to attempt the impossible, and that is beating death at its own game. And according to a book by Michael Shermer, Heaven on Earth, The Scientific Search for an Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. And with scientific advancements exploding at an exponential pace, so there we go again, some believe that the Grim Reaper could soon be out of business. Here are three ways that scientists are striving for immortality that are getting so close to success that they would even amaze Bedford if he ever wakes up. Number one happens to be cryonics, and that is the process of suspending a just-deceased person in a frozen state until the remedy for what killed them has been discovered. Then, theoretically, the person can be thawed out and cured. Science will only consider a person properly preserved if they can revive all of their memories with all their memories intact. Many question whether those currently frozen can be successfully revised. So currently, the cryonic process vitrifies the brain, turning it into a glass-like substance. Caltech, and that actually was in that Carbon Copies presentation, one of them. Caltech neuroscientist Christoph Cook, echoing the opinion of many experts, says it would be utterly amazing if this change to the brain's chemistry didn't destroy the synapses that hold the memories. Major champion of freezing is Ralph Merkel, a board member of the Alcor Life Extension Foundation cryonics facility in Arizona. Having performed their first human cryopreservation in 1976, Alcor now has 153 deceased patients frozen in, let me mention, its desert facility, including Bedford, and almost another 1,000 people have made arrangements to be preserved there when they die. Between Alcor and the Cryogenics Institute in Clinton Township, Michigan, there are at least 290 people cryogenically frozen in the United States. Merkel, 65, said of critics of cryonics that, like those in the early 1900s, who believe mankind could never reach the moon. And I would say I'd still question that theory. Merkel denies that current freezing technologies can preserve memory, claiming that vitrification, which is providing excellent preservation of the synaptic structure, and that experiments with roundworms have shown memory retention after reviving them from freezing. Yeah, I'd put all my bets on the roundworm. He also knows that the memory preservation occurs not just in the synapses, but also in the biological structures that surround them. We found that out in some webinar that we had watched. I think it might have also been the uploading webinar. Merkel believes that the next few decades or perhaps centuries, technology will make repairs to those bodies while they are frozen so they can be thawed with all the flaws and the ailments corrected. At some point in the future, they will have technology that can make the damaged structure of the brain that can fix the damaged structure of the brain, analyze it, and recover the information. Once you can recover that information, you can restore the damaged structure with the memory and the information content intact. Some believe that one day we will extend our lives by merging with technology, and that is number two. Those are the singularitarians, and they predict that there will be a theoretical future moment when artificial intelligence will overtake and either merge with or replace human intelligence. The premier evangelist for the singularity is scientist and futurist Ray Kurzweil, Google's director of engineering, who created the first text-to-speech synthesizer and the flatbed scanner. And as technology continues to accelerate, Kurzweil believes that we'll reach a point where, quote, the world will change more in a decade than in a thousand centuries. And as the acceleration continues, we'll reach the singularity, and the world will change more in a year than in all pre-singularity history. So when that happens, humans will achieve immortality. Kurzweil explained his vision for life extension in a Playboy interview quoted in Sherman's book. And by the 2030s, we will have nanobots that can go into our brain and non-invasively through our capillaries and connect to our neocortex. We heard this one. And basically connect it to a synthetic neocortex that works the same way in the cloud. So we have an additional neocortex, and we'll use it to add additional levels of abstraction. Not only will nanobots give us greater brain power, they'll also make us healthier, we remember that interview, and sexier, and extend our lifespans while we are alive. So as they gain traction in the 2030s, nanobots in our bloodstream will destroy pathogens, remove debris, rid our bodies of clots, as well. First but not least, mind uploading. Proponents of mind uploading go further than Kurzweil, believing that you won't even need a brain or a body to exist because one day human consciousness will live on a computer. You will become a ghost in the machine. The key to uploading the brain is the connectome, which is the comprehensive map of the brain's neural connections and pathways that equals the sum of the total of one's brain function. Scientists are currently trying to figure out how to assemble and preserve the connectome of the brain. Once that is achieved, they will theoretically be able to download a human being's conscious mind. To this end, the Brain Preservation Foundation, of which Shermer, who wrote that book, is on the advisory board, announced a prize for companies that can figure out how to preserve brains and, by extension, their connectomes. In 2016, the 21st Century Medicine in Fontana, California, was awarded the Brain Preservation Prize, ding, ding, for small mammals after freezing a dead rabbit's brain at temperatures even colder than vitrification and thawing it out to show preservation of a brain ultrastructure sufficient to establishing the connectome or totality of the all-brain, cell-to-brain, cell-synaptic connections that can be preserved for at least 100 years. This earned them a prize of just under $27,000, and the other 75%, worth just under $108,000, will go to the first team to, quote, successfully preserve a whole large animal brain in a manner which could be adapted for humans. To freeze the rabbit brain, the 21st Century Medicine, that must be the name of the company, used a technique called aldehyde stabilized cryopreservation, which opens up the blood-brain barrier and allows the cryoprotectant to enter the brain without causing brain shrinkage. Using the same process, the company also preserved several pig brains and has submitted one for consideration for the large mammal prize. That's pretty horrifying. Shermer visited 21st Century during the freezing process and saw both the rabbit and the pig brains in question, though he notes that none of the three rabbit brains the company froze showed any visible signs of ice formation or damage. The one pig brain did have a dime-sized ice smudge on the occipital lobe near the cerebellum. So it's not a good sign, he notes, but this is not yet a perfect science. Yeah, so don't step right up, because you'll become one of the early guinea pigs. So then I came across a story the other day, January 30th, 2018. Google and their Calico Labs, if you guys remember, we talked about them a long, long time ago. Google wants to use the naked mole rat to conquer death. They are ugly as sin, but they could help us live longer. Gorpsunian law is hard to spell, but it is pretty easy to understand. the older a mammal is, the more likely it is to die. And that is just a fact of life, except apparently for a naked mole rat. A new study from Calico Labs, which is a moonshot goal of unlocking the secrets of aging from the parent Google, found that the bald rodent's risk of death isn't necessarily proportionate to its age. The creepy, hairless critter, which was famously featured as an anthropomorphic, nacho-loving sidekick in the cartoon Kim Possible, has an unusually long lifespan and a host of characteristics that make it seemingly relatively invincible. Naked mole rats don't appear to feel pain the way most mammals do, and only a few individuals out of the 100 studied are known to develop cancer. They can also hold their breath for 18 minutes at a time with apparently no side effects whatsoever. So unfortunately, this doesn't mean that naked mole rats hold the key to immortality. I hate to burst your bubble, says Stephen Broad, professor of the practice of biology in the department at the University of Washington in St. Louis. Bowd works with the naked mole rat, and he wasn't involved in the study, but says that while the animals are likely to die off young in the wild because of predators or other natural factors, the few critters who do survive that vulnerable period tend to live for a very long time. And that is consistent with the longevity that Calico studies has shown in their lab population. The overall rate of survival in the lab was obviously much higher, however, since natural factors were removed. But the survival rate and the longevity isn't unique to naked mole rats. Broad gives the example of the tortoise or an oak tree. In the wild, both organisms can have long lifespans, but only if the seedlings, or baby tortoises make it past everything that's trying to eat them. Mice, on the other hand, only live for about 3 years in the wild or in the laboratory. It doesn't seem to matter whether or not they are in a safe environment. They get old, or as they get older, they are more likely to die. So why should we care about naked mole rats as opposed to sea tortoises or 100-year-old giant clams? And why is Alphabet, the parent company of Google, pouring money into the research of the rodent at Calico? Well, most likely it has to do with animals' telomeres. Telomeres are like the cap on an open new pen. They protect the strands of DNA from damage or decay, and telomeres themselves get damaged over a life cycle of a cell. That's as you do things like not sleep or drink or eat bad things. It's all about trying to lengthen those telomeres. And this highly scientific molecular process is more commonly known as aging, and it is something that the billionaire founders of Google and Amazon and PayPal would like to put an end to. Naked mole rats appear to be able to protect their telomeres, and so that's why we're looking at them. That is going to take us to another story that we read quite a long time ago. I'm sorry, I can't get to any of those tabs on my other machine, so I'm going to have to do these one by one and look them back up again. All right, this one was titled Tech Titans' Latest Project, Defy Death, The Human Upgrade, out of the Washington Post, and I think the story was from 2015, April 4th, 2015. For centuries, explorers have searched the world for the Fountain of Youth, and today's billionaires believe that they can create it using technology and data. Get excited, because that is how that technocracy is coming in. And there is one more story that I want to make sure before we get too far into this one that I get up, because it is very important to add to this pile of feces that we have laid out today, because this is really what they are doing. Oh, come on. It wasn't that far back. Sorry for being disorganized. Here it is. All right. So tech titans want to defy death, and billionaires believe they can do it utilizing technology and data. Seated at the head of a table for 12, with a view of the city's soaring skyline, Peter Thiel was in deep conversation with his guests, eclectic scientists whose research were considered radical and even heretical. It was 2004, and Thiel had recently made a tidy fortune selling PayPal, which he co-founded, and then eBay, and he had spent what he wanted on himself, a posh penthouse suite at Four Seasons Hotel and a silver Ferrari, and now he was soliciting ideas to do good with his money and make a bazillion dollars. Among the guests was Cynthia Kenyon, a molecular biologist and a biogerontologist who had garnered attention for doubling the lifespan of a roundworm by disabling a single gene. Aubrey de Grey, a British computer scientist turned theoretician who prophesied that medical advances could stop aging. And then, of course, you had Larry Page, a co-founder of an internet search darling called Google that had big ideas on improving health through terabytes of data that it was collecting. And the chatter at the dinner party meandered from the value of chocolate in one's diet to the toll of disease in the U.S. economy to the merits of uploading people's memory to computers versus cryo-freezing their bodies. Ding, ding, that is the sentence that puts everything we talked about today all together in one neat little package. Yet the focus kept returning to one subject, and that was the inevitability of death, or is it a solvable problem? Well, the number of guests were skeptical about achieving immortality. Could science and technology help us live longer and say maybe to 150 years? And now that they agreed that it was all a worthy goal. So within a few months, Thiel started writing checks, and don't worry about it because it accelerated their work. Now wait until you hear this. These guys weren't involved, but again, still billionaires that are putting their foot into this latest investment vehicle. That'd be the investment vehicle of you and all of your health data. Amazon, Chase Manhattan, and Berkshire Hathaway, that would be Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, and Jamie Dimon, all partner up to disrupt healthcare. What? Oh, yes. Amazon has joined forces with Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan Chase in a bid to slash healthcare costs for their 1.1 million employees, creating a possible black swan event that could disrupt the healthcare industry. Together, the three partners will combine resources to create an independent company that will initially focus on, quote, technology solutions, unquote, to provide, quote, high quality and transparent healthcare at a reasonable cost. Here comes the Internet of Things. Amazon is well poised to enter and disrupt the healthcare industry as we know it, says Forrester senior analyst Kate McCarthy, and they have the scale and the digital and the customer experience capacity to bring efficiencies and improvements to the industry that are long overdue. We are working out the business with their own employees first is a smart way to test out the product before opening it up to the general market, she said, and that could be a game changer. So here we go. This is going to be the solution to our national healthcare problem. Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon, and JP Morgan Chase, all doling out your healthcare. I am not going to call this a black swan event yet because there are a few details, and I'd be making too many assumptions, but it has potential to be, says Jared Holtz, an analyst at Jefferies. The development is even more promising than the American news that Amazon was getting into the prescription drug business. Of course they are, and the stock market seems to agree. Wall Street responded swiftly to the news with shares of CVS, United Health, and Aetna all seeing their shares take a tumble up to 8%, and pharmacy benefit manager Express Scripts fell nearly 5%. The ballooning costs of healthcare act as a hungry tapeworm on the American economy, says Buffett in a joint statement announcing their partnership. We share the belief that putting our collective resources behind the country's best talent can in time check the rise of healthcare costs while concurrently enhancing patient satisfaction and outcomes. Our goal is to create solutions that benefit our U.S. employees, their families, and potentially all Americans, says Jamie Dimon, chairman and CEO of JP Morgan Chase. The soaring price of healthcare, and by the way, there's all kinds of projects for blockchain going on with JP Morgan. And also Amazon has their Amazon Web Services blockchain. So don't think this isn't going to usher all of that technology in and put your medical records out there. It's all going to be paid for by the billionaires that run the world. The soaring price of healthcare has drawn a new light on an interconnected machine of players that compromises the U.S. healthcare system. Before a drug reaches a patient, it effectively passes through the control of the drug maker, an insurer, a pharmacy benefit manager, a wholesale distributor, and a pharmacist, which each take their cut along the way. So they're going to cut out the middleman with the blockchain. I'm telling you, that's exactly what they're talking about here. Most patients never see the real cost of a drug and have grown accustomed to paying the normal $30 or the copay for many prescriptions. But as health plans have rejiggered the control costs, many patients have gotten exposed to paying the full list price at the pharmacy counter, which can run into the hundreds of dollars, and that has patients, parents, and politicians up in arms. So they're going to fix that one. During the controversy of the $600 EpiPen, the company's CEO drew a new bead on one of the cogs in the healthcare system, suggesting they were to blame for the cost of the markup. Insurers, frequently involved in the contentious lawsuit with one another over pricing and profit, all adding to the pressure of new ways to reduce the cost of healthcare. These are three great companies, wink, and three smart CEOs, but I kind of take this in some way as if healthcare experts say they're going to fix the banking industry, says Merritt. I think healthcare solutions are better solved on the back end rather than taking what people's aspirations are. But now we have multi-billionaires getting into healthcare to dole out your healthcare. And there was one more story I wanted to try to get to, and I don't know where it is. And this is, I can't even get there. Maybe the future of wearable devices being responsive and self-powered as well as flexible. Not only will they be on your body, but they will be connected to the Internet of Things 24/7. Wearable electronic devices are the future of fashion and technology, and the next generation of such devices should be highly responsive and need to be self-powered. These devices require better integrated components and are currently the focus of an ongoing research project. And there's great need for this type of research, and these components would find applications in other future autonomous technologies, like being able to bag, tag, and track you to keep your health care and insurance costs down by giving them a dashboard to your real-time health and biometric situation. I just saw that there was some big project with the Internet of Things and aging and being able to monitor old people. And that's also a thing that they were talking about in some of the smart city projects. One such component required for imaging, sensing, and optical communication applications is a flexible, portable, and self-powered photo detector. And they can detect all kinds of things. All right, guys, have an awesome weekend. I will see you.